The Book Nook on WISO is made possible by six local library systems in Southwest Ohio: the Greene County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Midpoint Library System, Clark County Public Library, the Dayton Metro Library, and the Wright Memorial Public Library.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WISO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I'd like to welcome to the program today David Krugler. He's just published a novel called The Dead Don't Bleed. What a great noir title, David.
Thank you.
This is your first novel, eh?
It is. It's my first novel, my fourth book.
And these nonfiction books that you have published, there's definitely some connections here. You seem to be someone who has studied World War II quite a bit.
Yes. One of my books is a study of how Washington, D.C. prepared for the threat of nuclear war during the Cold War. And the first chapter in it is all about Washington during World War II. And that really sparked my interest in the story, the ideas that became The Dead Don't Bleed, because it was just such an exciting place to be. I mean, imagine being young and in Washington and all these clerks and stenographers and military personnel and doing the business of war, but living in a city that's so vibrant and brimming with energy and excitement. That's what really got me going on the idea.
And this novel, The Dead Don't Bleed, is set in Washington, D.C. It's 1945. The war is winding down. It's ending in Europe, and it'll be ending soon in Japan, but the place is crawling with spies. Now, why is that? What were they trying to find out?
Well, the Soviet Union began setting up spy networks in the 1930s after the U.S. and the Soviet Union reestablished diplomatic relations. And at first, they were looking for industrial secrets, anything to help them speed their economy along and modernize industry. After the war began, they were interested in U.S. policies, and once word leaked out, as it did, of this secret project to build a bomb of unimaginable power and destruction, the spy networks focused their attention on that. So the penetration of what we call the Manhattan Project, the atomic bomb project, was well in place by 1945. And my idea was to sort of take the espionage and situate some of it in Washington to make Washington sort of a midpoint for carrying on and transmitting these secrets.
The book is The Dead Don't Bleed. David Krugler wrote it, and he joins us by telephone from Chicago today. David, you've written this in language that seems very authentic for 1945. As I was reading it, I kept noticing the way characters spoke, and I really got a kick out of it. How were you able to distill and create this kind of language?
Well, my best friend in writing this book was my desk copy, this ex-desk copy from the Chicago Sun-Times news desk on American slang, published in 1960. I found it in a used bookstore, picked it up for a few books, and it's been invaluable. Because it was published in 1960, it has a lot of 1950s, 1940s slang, and it even provides examples of usage, especially slang common in the armed forces in the U.S. during World War II. On top of that, I do read a lot of mid-20th century noir, and so I tried to pick up as much as possible from that.
I had Ed McBain on the program 15 years ago, and we were talking about crime novels, and he said, the first thing you got to have with a crime novel, he said, is a corpse. That's what you start with. And by golly, you followed that formula perfectly. As we open The Dead Don't Read, we've got a body. Set the scene.
Well, we're in an alley.
The Dead Don't Bleed. I'm sorry.
Oh, no problem. No worries. So, Ed McBain's advice, his recommendation is perfect. And we're so accustomed to, seeing that body as we see it at the beginning of The Dead Don't Bleed that it takes us a while to realize this is no ordinary alley. So what we have is the body of a Lieutenant J.G. in the Office of Naval Intelligence, and our narrator, our protagonist, is also a lieutenant junior grade, and he's assigned to investigate. Now, normally in a city alley, the city police would take over the investigation. But we learn that the Navy has purchased the surrounding area by the Navy Yard to expand the Navy Yard. And so technically they own this property. And so Ellis Voigt's commanding officer decides, listen, you guys pull rank here. Take over this investigation because we want to find out if our corpse, Lieutenant Scarrell, was up to anything he shouldn't have been, which got him killed, and if it relates to national security, to Navy duties. If not, kick it back to the locals.
And the story is told mostly from the viewpoint of another lieutenant who's still very much alive, Lieutenant Voigt. And he's a very interesting character because what he's telling us about what he's thinking might not necessarily be true.
Right. As becomes clear as you read, Voigt's got some secrets. That's fairly customary for narrators in crime fiction. And I'm hoping readers want to find out what those secrets are and what he might be holding back and why he's wound a little tight and is a little bit stingy with revealing personal details, though they do come out as the narrative hurtles along.
I don't want to spoil anything, obviously, but I'm wondering, can we talk about the funhouse? Can we talk about who these guys were working for?
Sure, sure. So the nickname I gave for the intelligence training facility for officers in the Office of Naval Intelligence was the funhouse, Coney Island. I have no idea if those are historically accurate slang terms. They seemed appropriate, so I put them in there. And it's in the funhouse, in the training to be an intelligence operative for the ONI, that our narrator, Ellis Voigt, meets the murder victim, Lieutenant Logan Scarrell, and we learn from Voigt's revelations, some of the memories as he begins the investigation, that he and Scarrell did not get along well at all, that they were rivals. Scarrell was better than everyone in the funhouse. He was a true golden boy. And that, as it often does, created some resentment in the ranks.
And when they find him dead, of course, they're wondering who killed him. That's the main thing they're trying to solve in this story. And then there's a question of, well, had he been turned? Was he working for the Reds? Was he a Soviet spy, a double agent? What's going on here?
Right, right. And that's why Voigt's commanding officer wanted him and his partner, Lieutenant Terrence Haley, to begin the investigation. And they do uncover evidence that Scarrell was up to something. And then it becomes Voigt's primary task to find out what. So at that point in the narrative, he's still looking for the killer of Scarrell, but there's a recognition, an intuition that the motive for the murder is now tied up in the funny business that Scarrell was involved with. So Voigt has to go undercover at a news clipping service that's believed to be a front for the communist espionage. And in the course of the murder investigation, Voigt finds out that Scarrell had been to this news clipping service when he shouldn't have been, and that's what leads them to that business and to the spy ring.
Back in 1945, everybody read the newspaper, and they read the kind where you got newsprint on your hands. Nowadays, if people are reading the newspapers at all, they're probably reading them online. Things have changed a lot. You just referred to this clipping service. A lot of our listeners are probably wondering what the heck that is. What was a clipping service? What was the point of it?
Sure, they're long gone and long gone before traditional newspaper publishing met its current obstacles. But before the internet, businesses regularly subscribed to news clipping services to get newspaper articles from across the country on topics of their interest. And it was the job of these clipping services to subscribe to all the major dailies across the United States. And they came in and they had readers who went through them. And, you know, they had guidelines. They had the lists of topics that their clients wanted. And it was their job to clip them and mount them. And then they went into folders and they were delivered to the client so they could keep up on the national news in a slower and grubbier way than we do today with our phones and our computers.
So it's kind of like a primitive Google alert system.
You know, that's a great analogy. It was Google alert, just proceeding very slowly.
Mm-hmm. Can we talk about Voight going undercover? Because this is a big part of the story.
Sure. So the reason Voight is selected to go undercover is because the ONI has this concocted identity that another unit has come up with. And it requires someone who can do a working-class accent from the docks of New Jersey. It also requires someone who's fluent in German. Voight has the mimicry ability, and because his parents were German immigrants, he's also fluent in German. His commander's got a lot of faith in him, even though he screwed up his first previous task, going undercover. Gives him the green light, and Voight spends a lot of time absorbing the identity of one Ted Barston, whose father was an organizer on the docks in New Jersey and a committed communist, and was killed by the bosses. So the hope of Voight's commander is that Ted Barston, played by Voight, can walk into this clipping service, drop his dad's name, and get some kind of job. Maybe they'll employ him to read German newspapers, because this particular clipping service gets international papers. Maybe they'll just hire him as a driver. Whatever the case, if he gets a job there, he can begin learning what's going on, poke behind the scenes.
And Voight, also known as Barston at the clipping service, he also has a girlfriend, and he has a hard time staying undercover because he's got this girlfriend, and he has to keep breaking out of cover because he wants to be with her. Plus, there's the added complication of being young and taking advantage of the hormonal impulses of one of his coworkers. Wow, this is complicated stuff.
Yeah, and we find out that Voight really wrestles with the duality of his personality. He befriends and beds the young receptionist at the clipping service to use her as a source, and she takes a real liking to Ted Barston. And so Ellis is trying, as Ted Barston, to be kind to her, but to be true to the character that Barston is, he's got to be kind of a rough individual, not the kind who brings flowers, and is romantic. On top of that, as himself, as Ellis Voight, he's got this girlfriend, Livonia, who goes by Liv. Coincidentally, she's from Ohio. But Ellis doesn't know much about her, but he would love to know more. He really connects and clicks with her, and going undercover makes it very difficult for him to see her. He's not supposed to see her at all, but he breaks that rule to come up, as you noted, and see her. And in one instance, he gets to see her as himself after breaking cover on the very night the war ends in Europe, and mayhem and celebration break out right around them.
Now, Barston isn't the kind of guy to bring you flowers. In fact, he has a difficult time making sure he stays in character. He thinks, well, I'm eating lunch. I need to eat really fast, because that's how Barston would eat. And he's even gone to the point of having fake needle marks on his arm, because that's part of his identity as this Barston. He's got a little narcotics problem.
Right. The Ted Barston, the real Ted Barston, was a ship fitters who was dishonorably discharged for narcotics violations, for striking an officer, and all sorts of offenses. And the real Ted Barston in the story died in the brig of a narcotics overdose. And so the cover identity requires the fake Barston, played by Voight, to be a recovering drug addict. The Navy covered up the death of the real Ted Barston in the story to create this cover identity. All of Barston's living, all of his relatives are dead by 1945, so they figure, we don't even have to tell anyone he died. We'll just pretend he's alive and keep this identity for when we need it.
David Krugler joins us. His new novel is a thriller. It's a spy novel. It's a crime novel. It's The Dead Don't Bleed, and it's set in Washington, D.C. in 1945. I think they did a really nice job on this cover. I love the sepia tones and the red hammer and sickle. This is very nice.
I couldn't have asked for a lovelier cover. I just, when they sent me the cover art, I was thrilled. I just didn't have a specific vision in my head of what the cover should look like, but when I saw that, I said, this is it. It's just wonderful. And there's, you know, we see the back of a young woman, a pretty young woman's walking up the steps of the Capitol, and she's wearing a trench coat. And as you get into the story, you wonder, well, is this Liv? Is this his girlfriend, or is this someone else who's involved with the espionage? It's great cover art. I love it.
And Barston, as he's working for the Clipping Service, he becomes a courier. He becomes a messenger. He's supposed to drop off the clippings at various clients' locations. And as we're observing his behavior and what's going on and who is handing what to whom, we begin to understand just how these spy networks were working. Was it really like that?
Yes. Couriers were used during World War II by the Soviet Union. So their contacts, many of them Americans working in various positions in the U.S. government, would copy documents. In some cases, they stole them. And they had a very elaborate, strict procedure to follow to meet the couriers. Neither party knew each other's name. They used fake names. They made arrangements to meet at secluded places at odd and irregular times to never stick to the same routine or the same place, then pass the documents over. It was the courier's job to then bring those documents, whatever material was obtained, to agents for the Soviet Union. And then they were coded and typically transmitted through radio transmissions to the Soviet embassy or to Moscow.
I love these Soviet agents that you've got in this story. Of course, the Clipping Service has got several of them. But there are others, and just the way you depict them, the way you portray them, that's really enjoyable as a reader to see their behavior and the way that they act suspicious of Barston, that they wonder if Barston's real. And it's just a wilderness of mirrors, the whole thing.
Yes. One thing I learned in doing some of the research for the novel is, and of course readers of spy espionage know this as well, that one can't really determine who someone really is, and it's a matter of determining how many multiple identities they have or motives they have. And these individuals who work for the Clipping Service but are also committed communists don't think Barston really is one of them, but they're not sure who he is. And I think it bothers them that the head of the Clipping Service, who has the generic name Henry Himmel, a bit Germanic, but he's actually Russian. It bothers them that Himmel seems to really like Barston, and they're not sure why.
The book is The Dead Don't Bleed. It just came out this week. David Krugler wrote it. It's his debut novel, and wow. I really liked the twist you had at the end, because as I was reading and I got to a particular chapter, I felt like I'd been slapped in the face. I was so shocked.
I hope that's a good thing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I was like, oh, man, I didn't see that coming.
Well, that was definitely my hope, to present the reveal, the twist, in such a way that readers wouldn't have anticipated it, but upon the revelation, see the points at which it had happened.
So what was the process for you? How did you imagine the story? How did you make it real? How did you make it happen?
The story went through several drafts, especially to get to that twist to the end. I wish I could say that, you know, I meticulously plotted it out and then followed that roadmap, but it took some trial and error to get there. And I think that's because the development of Ellis Void as a character was a work in progress, even as the novel was being written. I started with some general notions of who he was and where he came from and what he was like. But the more I focused on the particular problem of the story, the espionage and the murder, the more it affected my notions of who Ellis Voigt was. Mm-hmm. And that helped lead to his transformation.
A lot of writers write just fiction. A lot of writers write only nonfiction. And then there are some that do both. And you have put out several nonfiction titles, and now this is your first work of fiction. How was it different for you to write a novel?
The major difference with a novel is that you begin with a blank page and you stare at it with terror or the blank screen. With nonfiction, you stare at a stack of research notes with that same terror. And what I mean by that is, with nonfiction, you've done your research. You can't make it up. But you have to make sense of all this raw material. So you have it, and it can be kind of discouraging because you think, well, I've spent all these hours to obtain historical documents and learn about this particular issue, and I'm going to write a book on it. But how do I make sense out of all this material I have? You have the reverse problem with fiction. You have a general idea of what you want to do, but where you start, whether you're going to begin with a body in the alley or an entirely different scene, that's up to you, and there are no notes, no research that can make that decision for you. You can be inspired by it, but ultimately, as a novelist, as a writer of fiction, you have to think about what's going to be most dramatic and effective, not what's most true to your research sources, which is what you have to do as a nonfiction author.
David Krugler joins us. Your day job is as an academic. You are a history professor at the University of Wisconsin, Platteville. Is that U.S. history?
Yes. I'm a historian of 20th century U.S. history.
So this is your bread and butter, 20th century history.
It is. And some of the things I do as a teacher inspired me to write the novel. I mentioned earlier that I've written this book about Washington, D.C. during the Cold War. On the espionage side of The Dead Don't Bleed, my interest in that topic as a historian was sparked by some seminars I did for high school teachers of history. I led some specialized seminars on the code-breaking project of the U.S. government known as Venona that uncovered all of this espionage. And doing those seminars with high school teachers in the Midwest and seeing how excited they were about the topic and all the questions they had, like, well, how did they do the code breaking? Why did people spy? There was just so much excitement and enthusiasm. I thought, well, maybe it's just not enough to teach about this, as important as that is. Maybe there's an opportunity here to write a fictional story. Some listeners may be familiar with a very famous atomic spy case from the Cold War, the conviction and death sentence for Julius and Ethel Rosenberg.
Oh, sure.
That the information about the proof of the Rosenbergs' participation in the spy network, that was mostly Julius, not Ethel, is proven by the Venona Project.
I see. Her brother was instrumental in sending them to the electric chair, wasn't he?
He was, yeah. He was the one who was a machinist on the atomic bomb project in Los Alamos, and he passed on information to Julius, who was an established contact for the Soviets, and he passed it on. Ethel knew it was going on, and at one point she typed a document, but that was the extent of her involvement. And the government thought that by threatening both Rosenbergs with the death penalty based on information her brother gave, that she would turn state's evidence, that she wouldn't allow their young sons to become orphans, but she stood by her husband's side till the very end.
Yeah, that was outrageous. Of course, in the 50s, all you had to do was type something, and that would get you the death sentence. I think her brother just died in the last year or two, finally.
Yeah, it was recently. Uh-huh. I think we forget what a shadow McCarthyism cast over the country, and one of the things that fascinates me as a historian is that you have this era in which, yes, there were Americans who were traitors. They were spies for a foreign power, and there was a problem with espionage. But the things McCarthy did absolutely nothing to uncover those spies. So you kind of have this push-pull going on, and I've always been fascinated by that. Maybe that's another source of influence and inspiration for The Dead Don't Bleed.
I'm intrigued with that period myself, and particularly the Alger Hiss case, Roy Cohn, the rise of Richard Nixon on anti-communism ballot in a way. And I'm wondering, as a history professor, do you find that the youth, your students, are well informed on history or maybe not as well informed as they could be?
Well, they come in not as well informed as I would like, but I take that as my challenge. And, you know, we can't expect too much of 18-year-olds. You know, how much did we know of history at that age?
A lot. Right, yeah. David?
Yeah. And we had a lot of excitement to learn more. What I like to do, and I find this to be a welcome challenge, is I look for that topic that's really going to spark their interest. And it's fun that it's different, you know, as the years go by. It used to be the Cold War that they were really interested in, you know, 15 years ago or so, because they were young at the end of the Cold War, and they knew it was going on, but they never really understood a lot about it. And before that, it was the Vietnam War. Now I find that the students really respond to the Great Depression. I think that's because, you know, since 2008 until recently, you know, you have the worst economic crisis in the U.S. since the Great Depression. So they and their families lived through it, and they want some historical perspective on it. So when we get to the Great Depression, they get excited about it. So it's really about finding something that they might have an inherent interest in, even if they're not quite aware of it, and then bringing that out.
Uh-huh. David Krugler has joined us. His new novel is The Dead Don't Bleed. This is really a noir espionage novel set in 1945 in Washington, D.C. How did you pitch this book? How did you get a book deal for this?
Well, I worked on getting representation first, and I began my query letter with that body, and a statement that during World War II, dozens of Americans spied for the Soviet Union, and then put it as a question, what if one of them turns up dead in an alley? And then I really tried to emphasize the atomic bomb project side of the story and to emphasize, you know, my ability, hopefully, to really set the scene because I was a historian and really take the reader into this world of Washington, D.C. at the end of the war with the excitement of victory looming, but dread about the challenges of the post-war era, including this network of communist spies. And I was really lucky to get representation with William Callahan of Inkwell Management in New York, and he loves the story, and that's how he sold it too. He really took it to editors and publishers, emphasizing that as well, and we were really happy to get a deal with Pegasus Books. I love working with Pegasus.
Yeah, it's on the Pegasus Crime imprint, and I was delighted to see that out of all the authors on that imprint, you actually live in the United States. They seem to have so many Europeans and so many European books that I never get interviews with them. So I was happy to be able to
time zone alone.
Yeah, actually have somebody from the U.S. with a book on Pegasus, I know I have a lot of listeners out there who love a good mystery. And so I challenge any of you to read The Dead Don't Bleed and guess the twist at the end before you get there. I bet you can't do it. So give it a try. David, we really appreciate your time today.
Well, thank you so much, Vic, for having me on the show. It's been a delight to speak with you. I look forward to readers' responses. I hope they let me know what they think of the twist. They can easily find me. They don't have to use a news clipping service. I'm out there on the Internet.
All right. Yeah, you can Google him. My guest has been David Krugler. His book is The Dead Don't Bleed. For the Book Nook, I'm Vic McKeonis.